This is World News from our Tehran headquarters. Welcome, I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is calling on his supporters to evacuate the Green Zone in the capital Baghdad, apologizing to the Iraqi people for the violence over the past 2 days.
I say now that I walk with a bowed head and I apologize to the Iraqi people who are the ones burdened with what has happened.
Sadr said that the spilling of blood is forbidden no matter which side commits it. Following his speech, his followers started leaving the Green Zone in batches. And that prompted security forces to lift a nationwide curfew, which was imposed amid the violence. On Monday, Sadr announced that he was quitting politics in response to a prolonged political deadlock. He criticized other political leaders for not heeding his calls for reform. And that led to deadly clashes in Baghdad, with Sadr supporters breaking into government buildings, including the presidential palace. At least 23 people were killed and hundreds more injured. Ottawa-based rights activist Faraz al-Najm joined us a short while ago and told us about the chain of events that led to the present political turmoil in Iraq.
This is a very difficult situation and timing for the Iraqi people because they have been through so many turbulences and developments and changes, and especially the last occupation of Iraq by the U.S. and then after that, you know, you had a big problem of chaos, and they tried to ignite obviously the American sectarian battles and cause problems between the Iraqis and cause more divisions. And then after that development, things kind of calmed down a little bit. And then after that, they, you know, the U.S. and their allies supported ISIS and then controlled a lot of areas. And then there was a big battle going on there. And Muqtada and his followers were part of the popular mobilization forces. At that time, you know, it was of great service, I can say, that Muqtada al-Sadr did serve the Iraqi nation at that time. But during his political process, unfortunately, he's made very unstable moves and moves that were not calculated many times. And this led to many problems inside Iraq. And also at certain times, he supported the wrong side, you know, when he should have been always allied with his real allies. And that is obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance. Just recently, you can see that he's not very stable person. I mean, look at what he did. He tried to put a government and form a government together. He got a majority with him and he called for a majority government. And then after that, he pulls out of the parliament. And then all of a sudden, he tells his followers to go inside the parliament and take it over. You know what I mean? Remind me of how Trump did the same thing, when he didn't get the results that he wanted.
Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has met with President Ibrahim Raisi and his cabinet on the occasion of the government week. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei hailed the performance and achievements of the Raisi administration. He praised the government for paying special attention and trying to build up national capacities. The leader also lauded Raisi's government for not tying people's livelihood to external factors. Ayatollah Khamenei called on the Iranian government to continue efforts to fulfill the needs of citizens and protect their rights. Raisi assumed office in August last year, boosting relations with neighboring and regional nations has been a priority of his administration's foreign policy. His government has also been seeking to revive the 2015 deal, which had been left in limbo following the 2018 withdrawal of the U.S. from the accord and its reimposition of sanctions on Iran. Calls are growing for the release of a Palestinian inmate who is in critical health due to months-long hunger strike in an Israeli jail. An EU delegation to Palestine has expressed shock at images of Khalil Awada shared by his wife and demanded that he should be freed immediately. In a tweet, the delegation said that Awada is in imminent danger of death. The 40-year-old has been refusing food since March in protest at his detention without charge by Israel. Doctors have already warned he's at risk of losing his life since he's suffering from a serious weight loss. Awada himself said in a message that his weak body represents the real face of the Israeli occupation. The Palestinian inmate has been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism. Has been placed under so-called administrative detention 3 times ever since. Some 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. Meantime, Israeli forces have performed yet another raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. A Palestinian house was a targeted raid. that resulted in violent clashes. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, joined us with more details on that incident.
This morning, Israeli forces raided the town of Rujib, North Nablus. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that they raided Rujib in order to arrest Palestinians are involved of a number of shootings against Israeli settlers in the last few days in the area of Nablus. After surrounding the house for several hours, and even Israeli troops fired anti-tank guard missile, they brought the father of one of those Palestinians who were inside the house. They were surrounding Nihad Awais and Nabil Sawalha, those two whom the Israelis say they are involved in shootings against Israeli settlers. At least five Palestinians were wounded during this operation that was carried out this morning.
Let's go on with some news out of Ukraine. The country is saying it's made advances in the south and that its forces are pressing ahead to take back the Russian-held Kherson region. President Volodymyr Zelensky has urged Russian troops to, quote, flee and go home. A senior advisor to Zelensky says its forces have broken through Russian defenses in several sectors near Kherson. Reports also saying that Ukrainian forces have targeted ferries Russia is using to supply its forces on the western bank of the Dnipro River. Moscow says it's repelled attacks in the south and inflicted heavy losses on Ukrainian forces. Kherson fell to Russian hands in the early days of the war. The Russian-controlled Zaporizhia nuclear plant remains another flashpoint, with fears growing over a possible radiation leak. On Monday, the International Atomic Energy Agency chief announced that he's leading a delegation to Ukraine to inspect the plant. Kiev and Moscow accuse each other of shelling the site. Now, Pakistan is going through the worst ever monsoon floods, with a third of the country inundated and more than 1,100 people dead. The government appealed for international help. Millions are in need of food, water, and shelter. The planning ministry says that early estimates show the country would need more than $10 billion to repel and rebuild infrastructure. Our Islamabad correspondent Nasser Kazemi has an update on the rescue and relief operations in Pakistan.
The tales of agony and pain are all around Pakistan, as the people losing their dear ones, household, residents, cattle, valuables, things, and crops as well. The emergency has been declared in Pakistan and the rescue operations are underway. However, the scale of this disaster was so high that the government is unable to cope the situation at the moment. In past 24 hours, there was a little lull in the rains and the floods, but now we have received the new warning from a national disaster management body who warned that more floods could be more floods are predicted in various parts of the country, especially in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province as well as the Sindh province. The problem is that half of Pakistan is underwater now, and the rescue operations are underway, but they are facing difficulties to reach those people who are stranded in remote areas. The infrastructures have been damaged worsely, so there is no way out to reach those people. The government is trying its best to overcome the situation. The military is in the field now. They are using their helicopters to rescue people. They are using the boats and other resources, but the massive floods have displaced over 33 million people in Pakistan. So international NGOs are in Pakistan now. They are moving to those areas where the help is required.
The US dollar has remained the world's top currency when it comes to trade, but its standing is increasingly coming under threat. Countries like Iran, China, and Russia are giving it a run for the money, challenging the standing of the U.S. dollar to be the world's top currency. Iran's central bank has announced that the country and Russia plan to de-dollarize several sectors in their commercial relations, in line with their previous moves.
Iran's central bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, US-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the US may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from US dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately that is hurting the United States. And it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies.
Now, more governments and central banks are looking into ways to break away from the dollar settlement and payment system following the 2008 financial crisis that originated in the U.S., and quickly turn into a global catastrophe. Today, Russia, China, and Iran are leading this effort. China and Russia are offering many Asian and African countries ways to release themselves from the dollar's dominance.
Since the U.S. has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the U.S. maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffused the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation building policies of the US regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to US expansionism.
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., lawyers representing the former President Donald J. Trump in the investigation into his handling of classified documents have tried out an array of defenses as they seek to hold off the Justice Department. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled Trump's legal team scrambles to find an argument. On 25th of May, one of former President Donald J. Trump's lawyers sent a letter to a top Justice Department official laying out the argument that his client had done nothing illegal by holding on to a trove of government materials when he left the White House. The letter from M. Evan Corcoran, a former federal prosecutor, represented Mr. Trump's initial defense against the investigation into the presence of highly classified documents in unsecured locations at his members-only club and residence at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. It amounted to a three-page hodgepodge of contested legal theories, including Mr. Corcoran's assertion that Donald Trump possessed a nearly boundless right as president to declassify materials, and an argument that one law governing the handling of classified documents does not apply to a president. M. Evan Corcoran asked the Justice Department to present the letter as exculpatory information to the grand jury investigating the case. Government lawyers found it deeply puzzling. They included it in the affidavit submitted to a federal magistrate in Florida in their request for the search warrant they later used to recover even more classified materials at Mar-a-Lago. To demonstrate their willingness to acknowledge Mr. Corcoran's arguments, a person with knowledge of the decision has said. As the partial release of the search warrant affidavit on Friday included the 25th of May letter, illustrated Donald Trump is going into the battle over the documents with a hastily assembled legal team. The lawyers have offered up a variety of arguments on his behalf, that have yet to do much to fend off a Justice Department that has adopted a determined, focused, and so far largely successful legal approach. He needs a quarterback who's a real lawyer, said David Schoen, a lawyer who defended Donald Trump in his second Senate impeachment trial. David Schoen called it an honor to represent Mr. Trump, but said it was problematic to keep lawyers rotating in and out, often tinged with Donald Trump's own bombast and sometimes conflating his powers as president with his role as a private citizen. The legal arguments put forth by his team sometimes strike lawyers not involved in the case as much about setting a political narrative than about dealing with the possibility of a federal prosecution. There seems to be a huge disconnect between what's actually happening, a real-life court case surrounding a real-life investigation, and what they're actually doing, which is treating it like they've treated everything else, recklessly and thoughtlessly. Chuck Rosenberg, a former U.S. attorney and FBI official, said of Donald Trump's approach, and for an average defendant on an average case, that would be a disaster. Donald Trump's legal team has had a few small procedural wins. On Saturday, a federal judge in Florida signaled that she was inclined to support Mr. Trump's request for a special master to review the materials seized by the government in the search of Mar-a-Lago on 8th of August. It is not clear how much the appointment of a special master would slow or complicate the government's review of the material. Donald Trump's team has suggested that it would be a first step towards challenging the validity of the search warrant, but it also gives the Justice Department, which is expected to respond this week, an opportunity to air new details in public through their legal filings. Some of the Trump lawyers' efforts have also appeared ineffective or misdirected. M. Evan Corcoran, in his 25th of May letter, made much of Donald Trump's powers to declassify material as president and cited the specific law on the handling of classified material that he said did not apply to a president. The search warrant, however, said federal agents would be seeking evidence of three potential crimes, none of which relied on the classification status of the documents found at Mar-a-Lago. The law on the handling of classified material cited by M. Evan Corcoran in the letter was not among them. Two lawyers are working with Donald Trump on the documents case. M. Evan Corcoran and Jim Trusty have prosecutorial experience with the federal government, but the team was put together quickly. Jim Trusty was hired after Donald Trump saw him on television, people close to the former president have said. M. Evan Corcoran came in during the spring, introduced by another Trump advisor during a conference call in which Mr. Corcoran made clear he was willing to take on a case that many of Mr. Trump's other advisors were seeking to avoid, people briefed on the discussion have said. Donald Trump's allies have reached out to several other lawyers, but have repeatedly been turned down. Mr. Corcoran, in particular, has raised eyebrows within the Justice Department for his statements to federal officials during the documents investigation. People briefed on the investigation say officials are uncertain whether Mr. Corcoran was intentionally evasive or simply unaware of all the materials still kept at Mar-a-Lago and found during the 8th of August search by the FBI. Mr. Corcoran did not respond to a request for comment. Taylor Budowich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, said only that Mr. Trump and his legal team continue to assert his rights and expose the Biden administration's misuse of the Presidential Records Act, which governs all pertinent facts, has been complied with, and has no enforcement mechanism. Even before Mr. Corcoran joined Donald Trump's legal team, Trump's legal filings in various cases read like campaign rally speeches that he had dictated to his lawyers. The former president has a history of approaching legal proceedings as if they are political conflicts, in which his best defense is the 74 million people who voted for him in the 2020 election. The closest thing to a legal quarterback in Donald Trump's orbit is Boris Epstein, a one-time lawyer at the firm Milbank, who was a political advisor to Donald Trump in 2016, ultimately becoming a senior staff member of his inaugural effort and then a strategic advisor on the 2020 campaign. Boris Epstein has championed Donald Trump's claims, dismissed by dozens of courts of law, that the election was stolen from him, and has risen to a role he has described to colleagues as an in-house counsel, helping to assemble Donald Trump's current legal team. Mr. Trump's advisors continue to insist that he was cooperating before the search in returning the documents. They have also suggested that they were quick to respond to Justice Department concerns, citing what they described as a request in June that a stronger lock be placed on the door leading to the storage area, where several boxes of presidential records had been kept. Yet the unsealed affidavit showed a portion of a letter from a Justice Department lawyer sent to Donald Trump's legal team that did not specify anything about a lock and read less like a request and more like a warning. The classified documents taken from the White House have not been handled in an appropriate manner or stored in an appropriate location, the letter read. Accordingly, we asked that the room at Mar-a-Lago where the documents had been stored be secured and that all of the boxes that were moved from the White House to Mar-a-Lago, along with any other items in that room, be preserved in that room in their current condition until further notice. During the search on 8th of August, the FBI found additional documents in that area and also on the floor of a closet in Mr. Trump's office, people briefed on the matter have confirmed. Donald Trump and a small circle within his group of current advisers maintain that he was entitled to keep documents he took from the White House, or that he had already declassified them, or that they were packed up and moved by the General Services Administration, an assertion flatly denied by that federal agency. Donald Trump, people familiar with his thinking say, sees the Attorney General Merrick Garland not as the federal government's chief law enforcement officer, but rather as a political foe and someone with whom he can haggle about how much anger exists over the situation. Shortly before Merrick Garland announced that he was seeking to unseal the search warrant, an intermediary for Donald Trump reached out to a Justice Department official to pass along a message that the former president wanted to negotiate, as if he were still a New York developer. The message that Donald Trump wanted conveyed, according to a person familiar with the exchange, was, "The country is on fire. What can I do to reduce the heat?" A Justice Department spokesman would not say if the message ever made it up to Merrick Garland. But the senior leadership was befuddled by the message and had no idea what Mr. Trump was trying to accomplish, according to an official.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha, at the very onset of his government, where he began to explain about certain important issues. And one of those issues that he really strikes at is the issue of understanding and recognizing the truth and falsehood, and to always be in the authority, under the authority of truthfulness, of true, or of what is true, of what is right, to be under the authority of the righteous. And of course, we say that this is by clearly announcing, by declaring clearly that you are in the right path and adhering to the true principles, and not to look for a leeway and kind of find gray areas where it's between the truth and falsehood, which does not exist. Truth is the light. Whatever beyond that is all darkness. There's no, for example, kind of compromise between these two things. And to understand that, to realize it, to follow it, to be under his authority, this is important, very clear. And that is why Imam Ali alayhi salam started with that. Because his authority, which is the authority of the truth, would never be able to prevail if people are not ready. Of course, truth will finally prevail. But unfortunate are those who do not want to put themselves in that, under that authority. They lose it, lose out in themselves. So Imam Ali alayhi salam brings about this issue, and unfortunately, of course, there are people who are not ready to accept and to adhere. They were ready to speak about it, but they were not ready to adhere, and unfortunately they fell off from that speedy train that was taking them towards paradise.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We know that when Imam Ali alayhi salam came to power, there were people who, I mean, a large group of people came and they claimed that they want to follow Imam Ali, that they are adherents of the truth. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he looked at those faces that had come to, give bay'ah and to pledge their allegiance to him, he had seen faces that were that couldn't bear the path of truth. They will just move away. They cannot do it. And therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam needed to vaccinate the community, vaccinate the society with words that will kind of prepare them for that imminent threat that was going to come in the future. Imam Ali al-Salam could see that people like Talha and Zubair, people like Sa'd bin Abil Sa'd ibn Abil Waqas, and people like him are not going to be able to bear the government of truth. They will not be able to survive this clear path that Imam Ali alayhi salam was bringing. I mean, as I said, many people are ready to say that they are adherents of the truth, but when it comes to practice, when they see the looming apparent disadvantages that they have in their, you know, somewhat comfortable lives, they kind of, you know, sidestep from the true path. And this is a reality that Imam Ali alayhi salam was seeing, and he wanted to prepare the communities for that. A leader who is aware, a leader that is, you know, following the situation, who is a persuasive and an understanding person. He can understand the things that are going to happen, and he needs to prepare those prepare the community for those. He needs to prepare those communities against those dangers, such that if that danger happens, then it shouldn't be something that was not predicted, or it is not something. If it is something that cannot be stopped, then at least the community should not face a very big harm. Or their energy shouldn't be, you know, lost completely, and they should still maintain that path. Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted to stop this kind of damage that was imminent. And therefore he says, فَلَئِنْ أَمِرَ الْبَاطِلِ لَقَدِيمًا فَعَلْ. Inshallah, we will continue this in the coming segment.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam here is trying to prepare the community for an imminent threat that what he was seeing was happening, and that there were some people who are not ready to come under the truth, and probably there would be a movement to go against some of the policies of truthfulness that Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted to, instate into the community. And therefore he says, فَلَئِنْ أَمِرَ الْبَاطِلُ لَقَدِيمًا فَعَلْ. If evil kind of overwhelms, or if you see that evil is in majority, like majority of the people, majority of the times, the majority of the situations, we see that evil is kind of taking over, then لَقَدِيمًا فَعَلْ. This has been happening since time immemorial. لَقَدِيمًا فَعَلْ وَلَئِنْ قَلَّ الْحَقِّ فَلَرُبَّمَا وَلَعَلْ. And if the followers of the truth, or if the truth becomes less in the community, the manifestations of truthfulness become lesser, or the people who manifest truthfulness are few, فَلَرُبَّمَا وَلَعَلْ, then that is also something that is possible. It can happen. You don't have to worry about that. Look at these statements from a leader. These are the statements that are preparing the community. He's trying to tell them, look, you guys are all seeing that people are coming here to me. They're giving me bay'ah, they're giving paying allegiance. As if now the truth has come back, and, you know, the situation is all good. But, oh people, I can see things. I, as a leader, can predict things that you cannot. And I can tell you that there is a chance that falsehood, you know, props up in between this community, and people start to follow that falsehood, and issues become very, very delicate and intricate to understand. Know that evil has always been there, and the manifestations of evil, the people of evil, the people of falsehood were many, and they can be many. And also sometimes the people of truth can be few. So do not be confused, nor should you worry about this. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Muhammadun
ولا هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that the suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aga Mustafa, was a serious event in the course of the Islamic Revolution and highly impacted the family members of the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini himself treated the event very calmly as if nothing had happened. Today, we are going to speak to you on the Imam's departure to Paris. Stay with us, please. As the family of Imam Khomeini was getting prepared for the first anniversary of Haj Aga Mustafa's martyrdom, the Ba'athist regime in Iraq decided to expel the Imam. Imam Khomeini, however, was not intent to capitulate to the demands of the Iraqi regime. Thus, he made up his mind to go to Kuwait. But the Kuwaiti government was forced by the Iranian dictatorial regime to reject the Imam's request. Therefore, after a brief stay on the Kuwaiti border, Imam Khomeini consulted with Haj Ahmad and accepted to go to Paris. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, "The night when the Imam wanted to leave for Kuwait was a strange night. Everyone was at our home. Everywhere was quiet. We slept at 12. Nearly 2 hours later, the Imam woke up for midnight prayer. It was peculiar. As soon as the Imam got up, everyone got up except children, as if no one had slept. Imam Khomeini got up to do his routine night job, ritual, ablution, midnight prayer, supplication and recitation of Quran. At that night, everyone was performing midnight prayer. Ahmad went to inform the friends who were supposed to accompany the Imam to Kuwait. He found all of them from the alleys of Najaf. They too had either not slept the night or just had fearfully taken a rest for an hour. Everybody was ready. Ahmad asked the Imam, 'Shall we not go?' The Imam answered, 'A quarter is left to the due time.'" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, left Iraq without his wife and other women of his family. The women were supposed to stay in Najaf until conditions would become proper for joining the imam. Lady Saghafi relates the story of the night when the imam left them. Everyone was doing something. I was preparing the foodstuff for the journey. Bread, cheese, walnut, and cuckoo. Imam Khomeini bid farewell to everyone. When it was my turn, he cast a deep look at me and said, I put you under God's care. It is nothing. We cannot disobey God. These people want to force me to give in. But pray that we move in the right way. I let the imam pass under the Quran, and Ahmad followed him. She continues, For 3 days, the workers outdoors thought that the imam is at home. On the third day, when our Afghani worker understood that what happened, he wept so intensively. At first, I thought that they knew and was surprised as I saw no reaction from them. Then it was clear that they had not known. The house was plunged in silence. Everyone went to a corner. Some were crying quietly. Their pillows were plunged in tears, but there was no voice. Nobody had heard the sound of our hearts breaking. The departure of Imam Khomeini and the unknown future condition was very worrisome for his family, particularly for his wife. Nevertheless, some of their friends not only didn't help them to endure tough conditions better, but they added salt to their injury by censuring them. The imam's wife recounts, When the imam left Najaf for Kuwait and then Paris, some of the wives of ulema asked, Why did the imam do this? Isn't it a pity to leave the holy Najaf and go to the land of disbelief? How can one compare the divine neighborhood of Imam Ali with Paris, the land of debauchery and unfaith? It was meaningless for them to see a source of emulation to go to France, as they didn't find it rational. For them, it was better to die in Najaf, even if it was with silence against the oppression, to living freely in Paris. Some of them thought that what made the imam to go to Paris was his inattention to other sources of emulation, so that it would be said in history he acted differently to become conspicuous among others. Ms. Saghafi relates her last pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon them. Any time that I went on pilgrimage of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl, I would ask them to accept me once more to visit them. I would pray and they would accept. But the last time I forgot to ask them my usual request, thus I didn't find the opportunity to visit them anymore. 10 days after Imam Khomeini's departure to Kuwait and Paris, the preparations were made for the trip of his wife and other members of the family. The imam's wife says, Upon the imam's departure, we started collecting everything to join him after holding the first anniversary of my son's martyrdom. I had no sorrow except leaving my son. Ahmad telephoned me and told me to go to France with Hussein. The tickets were taken for 4 days later, and we spent 4 days to gather everything. We would spend the nights to bid farewell to the commander of the faithful and my son Mustafa. I couldn't go to Karbala anymore. On the 14th of Dhulqa'dah, we left Najaf for Paris. I and my grandson Hussein went to Paris and then to Nufal Chateau. Ahmad welcomed us at the airport. We had the lunch at Mr. Karim Khoda Panahi's home and went to the imam in the afternoon. 3 days later, a house was taken for us. It was the house of Mr. Askari. It was the so-called bureau. The little appliances that had been prepared also belonged to the homeowner.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we will be looking at a very beautiful hadith which has been narrated from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. This hadith is about Allah's greatest name. As you know, Allah has, you know, many names. Al-Asma, he has many beautiful names, Al-Asma'ul Husna. But according to some of hadith, there is one name which is the greatest of all names. In this beautiful hadith, Imam Baqir alayhi salam kind of elucidates on what this name is, some of the nature of this name. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "Verily Allah's greatest name is composed of 73 letters, of which Asif bin Barkhiya had but one." As you know, there's a famous story in the Holy Quran regarding the Prophet Sulaiman, right? Prophet Sulaiman, he was sitting on his throne and his consorts were surrounding him, members of his government, you know, his closest companions. You know, these people were surrounding him. And he asked them, you know, which one of them could bring him the throne of the Queen of Sheba, Bilqis, and one of the members of the jinn said, "I can bring it to you quicker than you can stand up from your throne." Right? قَبْلَ أَن تَقُومَ مِن مَقَامِكَ. Right? And then the Quran says that there was a person there, present there, who had knowledge of the book, who had some knowledge of the book. Right? And we don't want to get into what this knowledge was, but he had some knowledge of the heavenly book. He said, "I can bring it to you in the twinkling of an eye." Right? This person, according to the hadith, was a person named Asif bin Barkhiya. And according to this hadith, this person had knowledge of one of the letters of the Ism-e Azam, the greatest name of Allah. When he uttered this, he was able to perform this magical feat and bring the throne of the Queen of Sheba into the presence of the Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam. The Imam says, "With the utterance of which he caused the earth between himself and Bilqis's throne to sink until he got hold of the throne, and after which he caused the earth to return to its former state faster than the blink of an eye." Finally, in the end of the hadith, the Imam says, "And we, the Ahlul Bayt, have 72 letters from the greatest name." Meaning, if that person had knowledge of one of the letters of the greatest name, the Imams of the